This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on SyncBook Radio. Today, on episode number 10, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, parapsychologist and author of the books Entangled Minds and Supernormal, Dr. Dean Radin, as well as a trialogue with psychologist and author of Unfolding, Dr. Julia Mossbridge. On this week's episode, both guests provide in-depth insights into the fields of parapsychology and consciousness studies generally, as well as the research surrounding presentiment specifically. Psychic phenomenon, also known as psi, such as presentiment, force us, I believe, to fundamentally question the nature of mind, matter, time, science, and humanity's role in the cosmos. Phenomenon like psi also reminds us that the antiquated notion of a, quote, conscious universe might not be as naive as we've been taught to think. Thanks again to my guests this week, and thank you for listening. Joining us today on Pentimental is Dr. Dean Radin. I'm sure many people know who Dr. Radin is, but for those who don't, he is the chief scientist at the IONS Institute. He has degrees in both electrical engineering and PhD in psychology. He has had various professorships at various universities, but he's probably best known nowadays for his work in parapsychology. So, Dr. Radin, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
So starting off, that was just a very brief introduction. So maybe you want to tell us a bit more about your history, where you come from, both your more conventional professional work and then how you got into, the study of parapsychology, presentiment, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, my first career was in music. I was a violin prodigy, I suppose. And when I started, I was 5 years old. And by about 10 or 12, I was getting full scholarships to music conservatories and was put on the fast track to become a concert violinist. And while I expect that I was somewhat talented, what my teachers did not tell me, and it took many years to figure this out, I knew I could play the violin pretty well, but I wasn't really all that interested in playing the violin, especially not as a career. And the reason is that what they don't tell you when you're learning an instrument is that being a musical performer means you're an athlete. Your body is your profession. And I'm not an athlete. I've never been able to be one of those people who exercises and then feels more energetic. When I exercise, I feel exhausted. And it's always been that way. So I just, maybe I don't have a large battery of energy that I build up. But for whatever reason, early on knew that I really did not want to be a concert violinist. And fortunately, I was also good in math and in science. And in college, I had the opportunity of switching into electrical engineering, which is one of the many things I've been interested in for a long time. And so I did. So I graduated as an undergraduate with a degree in electrical engineering with a concentration in physics, and then went on to get a master's in electrical engineering and decided at that point that I really didn't want to do electrical engineering as a profession. So I switched into psychology primarily because at the time, the primary way of doing research in artificial intelligence, which is something that caught my attention, was either through development of hardware or through development of software. And so the software approach was a bit more appealing to me. And the only person in the university at the time, at the University of Illinois, who was deeply into cognitive modeling and that sort of thing, was in the psychology department. So that's where I went. So it's kind of a historical accident that I ended up getting my doctorate in psychology, because most of my interests were in engineering and hard science. But that's just the way it happened. So when I got my doctorate, I didn't know exactly what to do when I wanted to grow up. By the way, I still don't. But even at that time, I wasn't aware that there was a profession for people who have a strong engineering background but were also interested in psychological matters, and it's called human factors. So you can be a human factors engineer or a human factors psychologist, and it's the discipline of studying the interface between people and machines or people and computers. So my first job out of the university was with Bell Laboratories, where my specialty was research and development on the human-computer interface. And that's because, like in a lot of companies now, the vast majority of people working in the company are doing something on a computer. And today, certainly, the vast majority of the telephone network is completely switched and covered and controlled by computers. So there's a lot of human-computer interaction going on behind the scenes. And that's what most of my research was on. So what does all that have to do with what I do now? Well, the answer is that, like a lot of kids who read science fiction and fairy tales early on, you're just captivated by the wonder of it all. And that's something that never left me. I've always been interested in science fiction. And of course, if you read a lot of fairy tales and fantasy as a child, you're naturally led into science fiction if you have any interest in science at all. And so I kept up with that interest for a long time. And I always wondered why in science fiction, one of the themes you see again and again is a general acceptance that psychic phenomena are real. It's just like, it's no big deal. It's just something that's there. So this is either because it's a nice story idea, and the same, by the way, goes for fairy tales and mythology and fantasy. It's maybe just something that we like because it provides a certain degree of mystery and power, or because it's reflective of something that's actually there. So I became interested in, even before high school, in reading a little bit beyond the science fiction and the fantasy and more into literature that was asking the question, I think, that a lot of people ask, which is this stuff made up or is it actually real? Well, that led to the literature of parapsychology, which I started reading when I was maybe 12 or 13 years old, and I had read probably most of it by the time I was in graduate school. And so I always had an interest, and I had been doing experiments on the side, outside of work. And then at Bell Labs, at the time, it's a little bit like Google is today, where they allow people to spend about 20% of their time doing anything that they want. So I had the luxury of time at work to start doing experiments in parapsychology, and to my delight, some of them worked. And my colleagues are usually quite skeptical, but they went along with it, and they said, you know, we don't know exactly how to explain any of this stuff, but it seems to be there. So that got me more interested in spending more time looking at these phenomena in the laboratory, because if psychic phenomena are in fact real, not in the way that you read in stories or see in movies, but real at all to any degree, then it meant that there's something important about assumptions in science that have shuttled these kinds of phenomena off to the side so far away from the center that in most journals you're not allowed to publish this work, and if you do publish it, you get into trouble. It's very difficult to do this in the academic world, and that all by itself became very interesting to me. Just the concept that there are taboos in academia was completely foreign to me. I don't ever remember having a lecture or a course on the sociology and psychology and philosophy of science itself. Maybe that's because I just never encountered it. But having now worked in a field which is considered controversial, I think it would be useful for any fledgling scientist in any domain to also learn about the history and the philosophy and the sociology of science, because it is nowhere near as rational as non-scientists think, and actually even as many scientists think. And that, again, that all by itself, if I had to do a whole other career, I would probably end up being a sociologist of science because it's so interesting.
Now, before we get into your work specifically, maybe then we can talk a little bit about the history. Where do you see the study of parapsychology coming from, maybe in the late 19th, early 20th century? There's definitely certain characters such as J.J. Thompson, the discoverer of the electron. You have Sir Oliver Lodge, a number of people that were interested in these sorts of subjects. But can you point to a specific place in time where it started to become more rigorous or started going into the lab, or how do you see the trajectory of it?
Well, the modern history goes back to the late 1800s. The first systematic society developed to study these kinds of phenomena was the Society for Psychical Research in London, and it's still going strong after starting in 1882. There was an American version that started a couple of years later. That's still in New York City. It's not very active at the moment. But those were the first systematic efforts. But you, of course, can keep going back in history farther and farther. And one of the first examples I like to use of showing that people have been interested in these ideas and testing them in some way start with the very origins of science itself. And, of course, way before that, you can go all the way back to the Greeks and go before that back to the Vedas. And as far back as history goes, people have been talking about these kinds of effects. But one of the first scientists or even proto-scientists who mentioned this was Francis Bacon. So Francis Bacon, among the half a dozen people who are known for being the originators of science as we know it today, Bacon's contribution was empiricism. He was the one who said and showed that if you have ideas about the way the world works or you want to study it, then put it to the test. And so one of his very first books where he talked about this, about how to test whether things like the force of imagination are true, and by that term he meant what we would today call intention. Is it true that your intention affects the world? He actually proposed using the tossing of dice. You toss dice while holding a force of intention, and then you use, at the time they didn't have statistics, but they used the equivalent of measuring how many times numbers would come up. And that's written in the very first book of scientific empiricism. So that's, I think, a way of saying, well, here is approximately where people got the idea that you could use empirical methods to study even things as strange as the force of intention. And of course, from there, you leap almost 200 years to the late 1800s, where the additional methods were developed. And of course, the other hidden aspect of this whole history is that because one of the very first phenomena, psychological phenomena, that people began to study was in fact psychic phenomena, because it's so curious, that many of the techniques that are used today in mainstream science were originally developed for the study of psychic phenomena. And that includes the development of the electroencephalograph, the EEG was developed for the study of telepathy, among other things. The use of statistics in evaluating psychological experiments was developed first for the study of telepathy and clairvoyance. The use of meta-analysis, which now is very popular in lots of different domains, to study whether effects are repeatable, can first be traced back to studies of ESP, and a half a dozen other examples like that, where what is now taken to be standards, including things like double-blind protocols, were first developed for the study typically of telepathy and clairvoyance. And the reason this happened is because the scientists who were looking into those phenomena were forced to come up with new methods to study these subtle phenomena in the laboratory. And the methods work, and that's why they're still used today. And most people who are being taught about these methods have no idea that they were first developed for the study of things like ESP.
And wasn't the Crookes tube, which I think was a vital component of the first television, basically stumbled upon because he was trying to communicate with ghosts or something like that?
Well, that's debatable. Certainly, Crookes was very interested in macroscopic PK effects, partially as a result of what mediums, physical mediums, were doing back in the day. And he probably was using methods that he was developing for other purposes and applying them to the study of psychic effects. And who knows, maybe he was inspired by something that he saw during a seance that led him to the development of the Crookes tube. But I kind of suspect that was developed for other means as well.
Now, can you also speak a bit on J.B. Rhine, who was a professor, I believe, at Duke, and he was maybe one of the first to, well, like you mentioned, people were already developing instrumentation to investigate this in a rigorous sort of way, but he might have been the first one to really systematize the study of micro-PK in a lab setting or in a very serious prolonged study. So can you touch a bit on his work and maybe how that inspired you or how you view it generally?
I would say that Rhine's primary contribution was the use of the ESP cards as a way of operationalizing a test for telepathy or for clairvoyance and later for precognition. He also did many tests using dice and other physical targets to look at PK effects. But the primary reason why he became so well known is because of the use of ESP cards, because it was able to take the phenomena out of the seance room and out of methods which didn't quite catch on because they were a little bit more complicated to describe. The ESP card test was something that everybody could do very easily. It was easy to understand. The statistics were very straightforward and simple. And he was able to get results that were compelling enough. And this is also an important part of it. He had a method and results that were easy for others to attempt to replicate. And so there are many, many replications, many in universities around the world. And one of the first compilations of all of that was in a book called ESP After 60 Years, which was published in 1940. So it included all of the ESP card tests from the 1880s to 1940. And that book actually is one of the first efforts at meta-analysis, because Rhine was very well aware that claims from his lab alone were intriguing, but they didn't really count as scientific currency until you looked at whether or not other people were able to repeat it. So he and his colleagues developed methods of looking across many studies to see whether this was a repeatable phenomenon or not. So that's how I think, besides popularizing the notion that ESP could be studied, Rhine's contributions also was in recognizing that you needed a way to encourage other people to replicate your work, and that's what put him on the map.
Before we go on, can you distinguish for the audience between macro-PK and micro-PK?
Macro-PK are things you can see with the naked eye. Levitation, movement of objects. There are lots of people. If you go onto YouTube today, you can see people making pinwheels move supposedly with the power of their mind. Anything like that that doesn't require statistics to see that something happened. Micro-PK is the use typically of very sensitive equipment or devices that produce samples that are small enough or that require statistical analysis in order to see that there was an effect. So that's the distinction. Obviously, you don't need to go to micro-PK unless macro-PK is strong enough and repeatable enough to study it. But the fact is that the vast majority of mediums, and this is where most of the macro-PK originally came from, in mediumship studies, the medium would bring people into a seance room, which was completely dark, typically. Not always, but almost always. And then large things would happen. There would be trumpets that would float around the room, and you'd see ectoplasm produced by the medium, and you'd hear voices, and these were all big, in-your-face things happening, usually in complete darkness, so you couldn't tell what was going on, really. It was a good show. They had no TV back then, and so it was a popular entertainment, and lots of people were fraudulent. They did it as entertainment, even though they're, of course, claiming that it was true. So there's a couple of cases where it's not so clear that there was fraud. They may have been genuine. But in today's world, there are very, very few people who still do physical mediumship. And the physical mediumship that is done, it's very, very difficult to get them to agree to doing it under conditions where you can demonstrate that what you're seeing is real, because they're still mostly done in complete darkness. So when you go into the laboratory, as I do, I don't have physical mediums that are willing to go into the lab and do things under my control. So we work with very sensitive systems where we take lots and lots of samples while people tend to mentally think at the systems versus not. And then we can make statistical analyses to see whether or not the system is behaving differently when they're being aimed at by intention versus not. And that's how about the past 50 years of PK research has involved that sort of thing, micro PK.
Now, one of the best recent explorations of psychic phenomenon was done at Stanford Research Institute, and I think that was carried out for about a decade. And if I remember correctly, you have some affiliation, you spent a little bit of time there. Maybe can you just tell us a bit about what happened at Stanford Research Institute generally and their investigation of both these sort of micro PK and macro PK phenomenon?
Well, the U.S. government program at SRI went from 1972 to 1995. It switched from SRI to SAIC, which is another big defense contractor, in 1985, I believe, or 86 maybe. But so it was over 20 years that that program was in existence. They focused primarily on clairvoyance, or what they used the euphemism remote viewing, as a means of doing espionage. So they were doing psychic spying, basically. They did a little bit of research on psychokinesis, but in comparison to the remote viewing work that they did, it was a very, very small percentage. I was there for the calendar year 1985. I had been at Bell Labs, and I took a leave of absence for a year to work on that program. The part that I was on was classified top secret at the time. Most of it, of that whole program now, is declassified. And what I saw in the program basically was that you have a cadre of very talented remote viewers who were engaged in various kinds of espionage for the CIA, for things outside the U.S., and for the DIA and the FBI and every other three-letter agency you've ever heard of for domestic cases. And they were very good. And so it was actually that experience for me in 1985 that I had been doing experiments at Bell Labs, as I had mentioned, but I wasn't really sure that you could do this kind of work as a scientist, partially because there's no money and there's no career and there's no way to do it, basically, as a job, until I saw what was possible to do at SRI. Because there they had substantial federal funding. They had the best psychics in the world working with them. And the people, the scientists involved in the program were also exceptional. I was used to people at Bell Labs who were all exceptional people. Well, this was the same caliber of person. So one of the main experiences or main lessons that I had learned from that was if you take resources that are common in big science, and you apply it to the study of psychic phenomena, you can actually go pretty far pretty fast. You know, science is quite good at learning things if you have the resources to do it. And of course, the thing is that most of the money that was used to support that program was interested in pragmatics. They wanted to know what the Russians were up to or what the Chinese were up to at the time, and they're using every trick in the book, including psychic means. And occasionally it was useful for learning something that they would not have gained by some other means. That's why the program was around for so long. So in 1995, the existence of the program became public. And then shortly thereafter, a lot of the materials were declassified, of course, with retractions of material here and there. But a lot of it was declassified at that point. And most of it now is freely available. You can buy CDs that describe most of it.
Now, why ultimately do you think it was abandoned? Was it based on results, or was it more a political thing? Or how do you view that, if you have an opinion on it?
I think it was a combination of two things. One is that the Cold War was more or less over that there wasn't a need for, at least there wasn't the same kind of need as there had been at that point during the Cold War, where the instability in the world was largely dependent on not knowing what the other side was doing. So there's a lot of concern and a lot of effort to see what the Russians were up to and see what the Chinese were up to. And so this kind of fit in nicely, you know, and considered as an exotic means of knowing what an enemy is up to. But after the fall of the Soviet Union, a lot of the effort involved in that kind of spying was no longer necessary. It dissolved, and a lot of the effort and money went towards other things. And remember, this is before the explosion of interest in the internet, and of course now, and also before a huge explosion in what the NSA has been doing as a result. So besides the ending of the Cold War, the other thing I think that caused the program to go public was that it was forced to, that the director of the program at the time went on to ABC's Nightline program and basically outed it. He outed the program. And so the CIA was given the task of supposedly evaluating whether it was useful. And since they were forced to do that and they wanted to get it off their plate as fast as they possibly could, they arranged for an analysis. And even though the analysis was more positive than they may have expected, they said, well, see, it's not really useful for espionage, so we're going to cancel it. And that's what they did. So it begs the question, if it was good for 20 years, why isn't it still good? And I think the answer is that it is still good, but if it's classified, I don't know if it's still in existence. And if there's any lesson that people in charge would have learned at that point is you put it very, very deep underground and nobody knows and nobody talks about it. And in fact, that is more or less how it survived for 20 years because nobody talked about it and somebody did. So government secrets work really well for a while, but not forever.
So maybe now we'll move a bit onto your research specifically. That's a wide spectrum, but maybe we can just focus on your presentiment work. So maybe you can first define for us what is presentiment, how you got interested in it, and then what kind of research did you conduct in it, and what results did you find?
Okay, so this comes from a consideration of the research in parapsychology, most of which suggests that one of the reasons why the results we see in the laboratory and the results that you hear about in people's lives, these phenomena are sporadic. They're spontaneous and sporadic. They're closely associated with strong need or motivation. So the classic cases are things like crisis telepathy. A loved one at a distance is in trouble, you somehow feel it. Or they get injured and you feel it in your body, that kind of thing. So that suggests that the phenomena themselves are probably always there. We're always impinging on us in some way, but they don't reach conscious awareness very often. Well, that shouldn't be too surprising because conscious awareness is a very thin slice of what's going on in our minds anyway. One of the estimates I read was that conscious awareness is picking up about 1/1,000,000,000th of the information which is actually being received by your body at any given time. So we're talking about a very tiny trickle of information that is impinging on your body through your senses, makes it up into your consciousness, because most of it you don't need to pay attention to. You know, there's sounds, there's sight and sounds and all kinds of stuff happening all the time. You can't pay attention to all of that and also be functional. So the brain learns after a while to only bring to attention things that you really need to pay attention to. I think the same, and not only me, but my colleagues as well, think that most of psychic phenomena are happening at this level as well. They're happening at below the level of awareness. So when I began to look into that, I realized that an easy way of testing what is going on below the level of awareness is to look at what's happening in the body. So this is what psychophysiology is all about. So I decided to use the methods in psychophysiology to see if you could pick up the reaction of the body before it was conscious. And an easy way to do that in an experimental case, people have tried this with clairvoyance, but I decided to use a protocol where it was not possible to cheat. And it was also not possible for even the experimenters to know what the right answer was. And to do that, you look at physiology before an event occurs. So you're looking at a future event. I use the word presentiment because the word itself means pre-feeling. And that's what we're looking at. We're looking at how the body responds before something unfolds. So it's a precognition experiment, but it's unconscious precognition. And I, of course, have heard many, many stories when people tell you about precognitive feelings. Sometimes they talk about precognition, pre-knowing, but almost always they talk about gut feelings. They talk about a sense, a visceral sensation. They talk about feeling states, which are not conscious yet. So this naturally lends itself into the laboratory very nicely because that's what psychophysiology is largely about. It's looking at how the body responds in an unconscious way to various kinds of stimuli. And I use the same methods, the same instrumentation, same everything, with one new twist, namely that the stimulus would occur in the future. And we looked at how the body responded in the present. Now, in order to make it a little bit more ecologically valid, because it is crisis that tends to produce these effects, I decided to use photo targets, picture targets, some of which would be calm, that you would see in typically 5 seconds after you press a button, and some would be very emotional positive, like erotic pictures, or very emotional negative, like accident scenes and surgeries and things of that sort. So in a random sequence, while you're wired up to look at your heart rate or skin conductance or your brain or any other aspect of the physiology, you would see pictures. And the analysis would then look at how the body responded before calm versus emotional pictures showed up. And what I found, I first did this experiment in 96 and found very quickly that we got astonishingly good results, very clear separation in physiology about 3 to 5 seconds before the picture was randomly selected. So I remember presenting in 96 or 97, I presented the results of these experiments at a conference for parapsychologists, and one of my colleagues said, "This is ridiculous. This is way too good." So he went back to his university in the Netherlands and tried to replicate the experiment, got the same result. So from that to today, there are now, I think there's something like 41, 42 experiments using the same basic design, different kinds of measures in the body. And a meta-analysis was published a year or two ago, and it shows overall very, very clear evidence that this is a repeatable effect, shows up in basically every physiological measure that has been looked at so far, and it's real. And what makes it even more interesting is that because the method that I used was virtually identical to conventional psychophysiology, that you could get data from conventional effects, effects that happen after a stimulus. But if you can get your hands on the raw data, you could look at what happened to the physiology before the stimulus showed up. So my colleagues have done that, and now there's 5 or 6 studies where the raw data was obtained in a conventional study, but it was analyzed from the point of view of whether there was a presentiment effect. These are typically before calm or emotional pictures, and sure enough, they found it. They found a presentiment effect in studies that were designed and executed and published for completely other reasons. And that fits with the notion that many of us have, which is that when we do these studies in the laboratory, we're not magically creating something new. We're simply finding ways of detecting what is always there and looking at it in a new way.
Can you better clarify what exactly is a meta-analysis? When is that a useful tool? Why are you using it? And so on.
Well, when you do an experiment, you typically will do multiple trials in one experiment. So let's say in an ESP card experiment, you could have 5 cards and you could ask somebody to say, well, tell me which symbol do you think this card is? And then they can guess it. And let's say they get it right. Well, so you could end. You stop the experiment. Say, well, I've proven ESP exists. I was hiding a picture of a star and they said it's a star and they got it right. And, you know, what else do we need to do? Well, the reason why that's not very persuasive is because maybe that happened by chance. So you say, okay, we'll run 25 cards. And then you say, well, how many out of the 25 did they get correct? Well, by chance, you would get 5. So let's say you do 25 cards and they get 8 correct. Well, okay, ESP exists. Why do we need to do any more? Exactly the same issue comes up. It's not very persuasive. So you need multiple people, many, many repetitions in order to form a statistic which gives you confidence that the effect is chance or not chance. And so you do that, and now you publish your experiment, and you show a significant, statistically significant hit rate. And now a colleague will look at that and say, yeah, I don't know if I believe that or not. Maybe you made a mistake. Maybe it was a fluke. Maybe it was fraud. You know, lots of maybes. So you say, okay, we'll try it yourself. So then they go ahead and do the same experiment. They get some kind of result. The result's not going to be exactly what you got, but it'll be something. So now let's say it was a positive result. So now it shows to a third colleague. The third colleague looks at these two experiments and says, I don't know, it doesn't seem like this is probably true. Maybe they're both flukes. Well, you play the scenario again and again. After a while, you end up with 20 or 30 or 40 or 100 studies. And now you need a means of using statistics on experiments, not on individual trials. So a meta-analysis, meta in this case meaning is like applying the thing to itself. It's an analysis of analyses. It's important because, as I said before, the currency in science is whether an effect can be independently repeated. And in order to know that, when you're dealing with statistical effects, you need to use you need to use statistics to measure how repeatable something is. And this is why in most areas of medicine, ecology, psychology, sociology, even its own form in physics, virtually every area of science which uses statistics, which is all of them, they all rely on some form of meta-analysis in order to demonstrate high confidence that the effect that one laboratory is seeing is the same as another laboratory. So that's what meta-analysis is about. And that's why it's proven to be especially important within parapsychology, because from a mainstream perspective, the existence of a psychic phenomena has low a priori probability. People would say, I really don't think this stuff exists. You're going to need to give me a huge amount of evidence showing that it exists. Well, meta-analysis is designed, in a sense, to say, is there anything going on when we look across laboratories? And the answer for a number of classes of experiments looking at psychic phenomena show very clearly that whatever is going on, it is a repeatable effect. It's not that much different than any other conventional psychological or social psychological effect that you would see in a laboratory. They're even of the same magnitude in terms of the size of these effects. So,
for me, statistics is still confusing as a layman, but from my reading of it, there's always the criticism of these experiments that, well, when you use one method of statistics, say the frequentist approach, you get positive results. If you use something called Bayesian statistical analysis, you get different outcomes. So what kind of like game is being played there? How can we distinguish between what is good statistics, what is bad? Is there a clear answer? Is it just more art than science? What's going on with that?
Well, statistics is ultimately all about mathematics. And I guess I have some sympathy for people who get confused with the arguments, because unless you can appreciate the math underneath it, then it would look like you're playing a shell game. Like you can get anything that you want and nobody really knows what it is, and mm-hmm. You know, it seems squishy. Well, it's not squishy. It's like any other realm of a discipline where you either know what you're doing or you don't know what you're doing. So statistics can be used or abused, just like any other tool in any toolbox. You can use it right or you can use it wrong. The arguments about frequentist versus Bayesian statistics, Bayesian is useful if you want to take into account the a priori likelihood of the thing that you're measuring. So if somebody is very skeptical about some psychic effect, they can put into the statistical analysis their lack of confidence in the outcome. And then if the results show a good result, it should, through when you crank through the mathematics, it should actually influence their opinion in a positive way, because it would show that here's your a priori opinion, here's how the data fell out. When you crank through the math, your opinion now should be improved because the data were quite good. The opposite could also happen. Maybe the data is not so good, in which case it would support your a priori opinion. And through that method, you're able to take into account the bias of the analyzer. In frequentist statistics, that's not the case. It's actually much more straightforward. Most of the arguments that I've seen, most of the statistical arguments I've seen leveled against parapsychology are flawed in the sense that in the early days and back in the ESP card days, there were lots of people saying, well, you can't use statistics in that way to evaluate ESP cards. It's just not right. Well, that argument ended when the president of the American Statistical Association was asked to evaluate whether the methods that Rhine was using were correct. And the president of the ASA made a very firm statement saying that the methods are correct. It doesn't mean that ESP is real, but at least that the methods that are using to evaluate it are correct. Well, today, the president of the American Statistical Association is the chair of the statistics department at UC Irvine. Her name is Jessica Utz. And she's been one of a very few but very long-term analysts of ESP experiments back since around the mid-80s when I got involved in this in a big way. And Jessica has written a number of articles saying that if you use the same methods, you use the same meta-analytical and statistical methods which are used in all of the other disciplines, it's very difficult to escape the conclusion that these are real phenomena. So if the president of the American Statistical Association and the chair of a prominent statistics department is saying that, then people who are saying your statistics are wrong are wrong. I don't know how I make it any clearer than that.
Now, what about like other criticisms that have been lobbed against the research? Say, oh, these aren't double blind, these aren't triple blind, these aren't quadruple blind. Oh, there might be sensory or information leakage. I mean, is there always something that can be pointed to in every single experiment ever done in science? Or is there such thing as an airtight study of any phenomenon?
No, there's no perfect experiment. There's always loopholes. And that's true in parapsychology as it is in any other domain. One difference in parapsychology is that the degree of criticism has been very hard, very harsh for a very long time. And as a result, when somebody conducts an experiment, any experiment in parapsychology, they know that they actually have to make it more rigorous than experiments in other domains. Because if you don't, you'll get ripped to shreds. And you'll get ripped to shreds first by your colleagues, not by the skeptics, because the skeptics generally don't pay much attention to the details of the experiment. But your colleagues pay a lot of attention to it because we know that we have to make it right. So after many years of doing telepathy experiments, the standard experiment that is used now called the Ganzfeld method closes every loophole that anyone ever knows. Or is ever raised even. So what you see in the literature among the skeptics is that they cannot think of a plausible alternative to the results that are presented in the experiments. That means that there's no obvious loopholes. They can't think of anything anymore because the experiments were designed to exclude it from the get-go. So that doesn't mean that it still doesn't have some flaw that hasn't been discovered yet, but that's true with any experiment. What you rely on is showing that there is response to valid criticisms and that the preponderance of the evidence keeps getting better as more and more loopholes are closed. And that is indeed the case for virtually every class of phenomena that have been looked at for many years.
So I suppose what does all this research indicate for you about the nature of consciousness? Is it all in our brains? Is it all outside our brains? Is it somewhere in between? And then what is the utility in any of this? Is it just interesting to know? Is it something we'll be putting to use in the future? How do you see all that unfolding?
Well, one thing it suggests is that I don't think it's fair to say that the consciousness or mind, we might use those as synonyms for the moment, it doesn't exist completely outside the brain. The brain is clearly involved in what we experience as humans, as awareness and as cognition. So there is definitely processing going on in the brain. It is a kind of an information machine. The question is that all there is? And that being all there is the current dogma within neuroscience today, that consciousness and all of its parts, it's all of the cognition and memory and everything else that defines who you are, is happening inside your brain, and the only way that you have contact with the outside world is through the ordinary senses. Psychic phenomena says that's not the case. At minimum, it says that there's something else. There's some other means by which we have contact with the world around us. At this point, we don't know whether you only need to make a slight tweak to existing physics. Maybe all you need is something like time symmetry, which is built into the mathematics of physics, that things should be symmetrical in time. Maybe that's all that's happening with these phenomena, that it's all some variation of precognition of one form or another. I don't think that that's the case. I think that there is enough evidence suggesting that there are aspects of the mind which are spread out in space and time. The time part would give us precognition, but the space part would give us clairvoyance. If that's the case, then one would expect that eventually physics would catch up to it in a way that would say, well, the physical world would allow for certain information to expand through space and time, or at least not to be bound by space and time. And up till about 1950, the vast majority of people assumed that physics was completely covered by classical mechanics, even though quantum mechanics began in the 1920s. Now most people realize that quantum mechanics is a much better description of the physical world. And of course, the strange thing about quantum mechanics is that the strangeness is all about phenomena that transcend space and time. So psychic phenomena then, just as it has been used to develop methods which are now mainstream in science in terms of the methodologies, I think also is a way of forecasting what is our future physics going to be like? Because the future physics has caught up with the nature of the experiential part of psychic phenomena. What's missing at this point is understanding about consciousness itself. And there, I think, eventually science will catch up to not so much what the psychics say, but what might be called the more refined psychics, who are the mystics. The mystics say that their awareness transcends space-time. That's what transcendence is all about. You're not just here, you're everywhere. Well, we don't know how consciousness can do that, but if you pay enough attention to leading-edge thinkers and the interpretation of quantum mechanics, at least some of them are saying that entanglement, for example, entanglement between particles exists through space and time. You can demonstrate that in the laboratory. If you expand that out without too much effort, you suddenly have entangled the entire universe. If we can experience that kind of entanglement, that's what you would call a mystic. So I expect that the study of these phenomena are important not only to verify to people that they're not going crazy when they talk about these things, but also because it's like a presaging of the direction that science is going to go in developing a better sense of who and what we are. So that's kind of in the philosophical and scientific direction. But there are pragmatic reasons why this is an important topic as well, one of which is in healing. There's a lot of people, and of course, long traditions of people using various sorts of distant healing or psychic healing. I'm convinced by the evidence in the laboratory that there is a connection between mind and body, where it could be your mind and somebody else's body. That means that our sense of why we get ill and how we get better has to include in some way what other people's intentions are. A medicine of the future, I think, will begin to recognize that the mind-body interaction, not only, as I said, not only within your own mind and body, but across minds and bodies, is going to become a more and more important consideration. And you already are beginning to see that within the domain of integrative medicine. It's still considered a complementary or alternative, but it will become increasingly important, I think. Another pragmatic importance here is how do we make better decisions? If we're faced with making difficult decisions with not enough information, which seems to be how the world is moving ahead, how would a politician or a military leader or even a business person or even an individual in their own life make a choice between this and that in the best possible way? Well, if precognition really does exist and it's a way of perceiving among different kinds of futures, it would be well worth everyone's effort for us to figure out how that works a little bit better so that we can all make better decisions and move towards a future which is better for everyone. So there are these kinds of practical applications which are things that are useful today, and there have been traditions which have used psychic abilities in these ways but have been shuttled off to the far fringes. I think eventually we may see a future which is more like techno-shamanism, where we see very ancient practices that are understood in new ways and that can be applied in ways that will make almost every aspect of life that we know of today, it would just simply make it better. So that's the long story of, or actually a sort of moderately long story of why, from a scientific perspective and also pragmatically, that these phenomena are worth looking at.
And people in more mystical traditions for centuries have been exploring the connections between the brain and our endocrine system, our nervous system, our immune system, and how that interactionism takes place, you know, how we can both psychosomatically heal ourselves, take ourselves to different states of consciousness, transcend reality, however you want to perceive it. But that's been going on for so long that I see this in a long tradition, only more systematized, more quote unquote scientific. We have more instruments at our disposal to explore these kinds of phenomenon and understand them better if we're willing to sort of transcend our education or acculturation about what is and is not acceptable or a valid methodology for exploring the human experience. So, I mean, that alone, it's like people have been onto this for a long, long time. It's just
right
in the Western scientific milieu. It's only now becoming more of a thing, but it's still, again, it's what do we see? Scorn and ridicule being tossed to kind of keep it at bay. It's not so much about the rigors involved. Oh, it's not. It's rigorous now, but maybe we should start redefining our conceptualizations of, you know, what is statistically relevant, what is not. So now disbelievers are just starting to move the goalposts further and further. So it has, you know, it's just a constant keeping something at bay, even though it's been obvious for so long.
Right. But I think there's a good reason for that. At least some of the resistance may be an unconscious fear reaction. Because the moment that you get the idea that it might be true that what you think is your private thoughts, what you think is your own, the sovereignty of your body, is not completely true, that's frightening.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's frightening for the ego to imagine that somebody else's thoughts could influence what you're thinking. I mean, it's like puts you on the verge of having a psychotic break. And the same is true for your body, that really somebody can do voodoo on you and you're going to get ill? Well, nobody wants that. So there's either consciously or unconsciously, there's this internal sense that that cannot possibly be true. Because if it is true, then everything we know goes away. And of course, it's not true that everything we know goes away. All it does is slightly expand things that we don't completely understand yet. But it is destabilizing. And so I have sympathy for skeptics who just will not go there. They cannot go there. In some cases, I would say some large percentage of skeptics were children who became so disappointed that Santa Claus wasn't real or that Jesus may not have been as what Jesus is said to have been, that they become very angry, either as children or young adults. And they decide they will never be fooling again. And they do that. And so they become cynics as adults. And anything which is presented that says, well, you know, actually, it wasn't all completely fantasy. There is some truth to some of this idea. They will look at that and have the same kind of cynical reaction that they did about learning their disappointment with Santa Claus. And they just never get over it. So it just takes a certain degree of tolerance of ambiguity, I suppose, as an adult to realize that actually we don't understand that much. science is pretty good. We've learned a few things, but there is a whole lot that we don't understand about ourselves and about the way that the world works and also what is possible. And that doesn't mean that Santa Claus is going to suddenly show up, but it does mean that there's lots left to learn.
Sure. And, you know, science, as we know it, has made so much progress by studying, like you said, a small slice of reality and what we perceive as a small slice of reality. We've mastered these sorts of linear systems that are easily experimented on, easily conceptualized, and that might be 5 to 10% of the universe, and we think we're masters of it, but there's this huge nonlinear spectrum of noise and other sorts of just intersecting forces and perceptions that are very hard to disentangle, if pick up at all. So, yeah, I mean, we're flatlanders, you know, trying to perceive these higher aspects of existence. And so, yeah, I definitely have a certain sympathy for the human condition on that level. It's all our reality tunnels are representations of our own limitations. So you'd have to be humble in the face of this stuff, but it's not easy. And I understand why people would be tempted towards a dogmatic stance, because that is, yeah, it's that animal security thing, amongst other things.
It makes you feel very uncomfortable. The moment that you really get how little we understand, it's very uncomfortable. And so I understand why people will sometimes react in less than rational ways.
Now, you brought up entanglement. Entanglement's always just an interesting thing to speculate on. And there's always the criticism that, okay, well, entanglement doesn't really transmit information. All we're seeing are correlations between photons, nothing classically like a signal is being transmitted in these experiments. So why would we think that people could transmit information between each other's minds faster than light? Because that seems to be what's indicated in psychic phenomenon, is A, something that's faster than light, and something that's not electromagnetic, because it permeates Faraday cages. It doesn't seem to be held by certain space-time parameters. So how do you conceive of information, or what do we just not understand entanglement? I know it's just a working hypothesis, but what's going on with that?
Well, and entanglement, I mean, all of quantum mechanics today is still linear, and nature is not linear. So quantum mechanics is not finished. In many ways, we've been somewhat lucky or fortunate or clever to figure out that quantum mechanics is a better description of nature than Newtonian mechanics. But it's still a linear method. The moment you add in some nonlinearities to it, either the Schrodinger's equation or to other formulations, then you can send information superluminally. So the game's not over yet. I'm guessing that because it appears that you can send information, although sending is not right, though I would put the word sending in quotes, you can communicate in some way from person A to person B through space or through time. Eventually, physics will catch up to this. And exactly the same way the physics had to catch up from Newtonian to quantum mechanics in order to be able to say, well, non-locality is a fact of nature. Non-locality is a fact of psychic phenomena. There's still a missing piece. Well, eventually physics will figure that part out as well. We're just not there yet.
Yeah, and real quick, maybe can you just explain to the audience what the validation of Bell's theorem is and what it means for just kind of the nature of reality itself, or how we should perceive it or could perceive it?
Well, in a nutshell, the argument back in the 1930s was that quantum mechanics can't possibly be true because it predicts that if you have two particles that interact with each other and then they go on their separate ways, that the interaction creates what amounts to a third term, an interaction or superposition term that describes a little bit of the other particle. You know, you have particle A and particle B and they interact and particle A keeps going and particle B keeps going, but now each is carrying a little bit of AB with them. And what that implies is that if you are only looking at particle A and you measure it in a certain way, that your measurement of it will also influence the AB component. The AB component is shared by both of the particles now, regardless of where they are. In which case, if you tweak AB a little bit, the AB on the other one will tweak also because they're part of the same thing. So this is this instantaneous connectivity that's sometimes talked about in entanglement. So for about 30 years, that idea just basically lay fallow because no one knew of any way to test it until John Bell came along and said that you should expect this sort of inequality if you do an experiment in a certain way, 10 years went by and Clauser did the first experimental tests to see whether such a thing was true and found evidence that it was. And so from about the 1970s until today, it's been tested many, many times. It's now very well accepted that these connections, these entanglement connections between particles transcend space and time, that they are quite real. They're being used for things like quantum cryptography and for communication systems. So it's gone from a theoretical prediction of a very strange form of connectivity to something which can be demonstrated now on a tabletop thing in an undergraduate physics lab. And that's pretty fast, from something that was physicists had to be dragged kicking and screaming to accept that that was true, because it radically changes our notion of what we think the physical world is alike. But nevertheless, because it is now fact-like, it actually transcends theory. We need theories that can account for these things. And as I said, I expect we'll eventually have theories that will account for a lot more, including psychic phenomena, because we do need a way of conceptualizing how information which is an A can end up at B without having been at B in the first place. So that will eventually happen, I would predict.
Yeah, and we see this even developing in fields like quantum biology, where they're exploring these quantum effects, whether it has to do with, say, avian compass, how do birds sense their relation to the magnetic field, the Earth's magnetic field, how do fruit flies perceive their orientation in space and time, how even do humans smell? Mm-hmm. And even DNA is being questioned as a quasi-quantum computer. So,
and photosynthesis.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're starting to unearth all these rather blatant quantum biological effects. And so the whole question of, oh, could there be these connections between people that seem to transcend, you know, our classical understanding is becoming less and less and less absurd every day, if it wasn't already so obvious to people. But I think it's really only a matter of time before that sort of awareness becomes so widespread that people don't have any real rational objections to it anymore.
Well, for people who are keeping up with the literature, because I still know people who say that it's not possible for the brain to sustain quantum effects.
Right.
And this for many, many years was thought to be basically a dogma, and it was a way of saying that classical physics is sufficient to understand the workings of the brain. Well, no, it actually isn't, probably. We're almost at the stage, I think, where we'll be able to demonstrate that even the hot and wet brain can sustain quantum phenomena long enough in order to see quantum effects happening. Like maybe we do have a quantum computer in their head. There's this term called quantum discord, which is becoming a little bit more popular now, which is a generalization of quantum entanglement. So it may be true that quantum entanglement, as we see with elementary particles, may not be easy to sustain in the brain. But quantum discord, as a generalization of that idea, says that there are degrees to which things can be entangled. You can have extremely high degrees of entanglement, as we see between photons, for example, or less and less and less, all the way down to classical entanglement, which basically is no entanglement at all. But in the middle ground, on a spectrum, you can have systems that are hot, that are room temperature, noisy, chaotic, whatever, and still have some degree of entanglement. So how much entanglement do you need in brains, for example, or nervous systems, in order to produce something that we would call psychic? Well, we don't know what the answer to that is yet, but we do know that there are ways in which systems can become entangled in a way that is analogous to elementary quantum entanglement, and in a sense, that's all you would need. Maybe psychic phenomena are generally kind of weak because the degree of entanglement between people is kind of weak. And maybe it's stronger in people who are emotionally bonded, and that's why psychic effects are stronger in people who are emotionally bonded.
Right, yeah. So objections to quantum effects in the brain really don't hold up anymore either. And you have, say, the Penrose-Hameroff model, or it's called ORC-OR, that, you know, there's quantum fluctuations being sustained in the microtubules, which are very high integrity as far as bioengineering goes and seem to be good houses for that sort of process to go on. So that too might be going on. And at a distance, that's someone that subscribes to, say, the Copenhagen interpretation would be like, well, so what? But On the other hand, people that still question, well, what does quantum physics even mean? That opens up all kinds of other possibilities between interactionism, between, again, the ambient and our brains and that interface. So that model itself, I think, represents an interesting opportunity, even though it's probably not the answer, but it's opening up new possibilities for what's going on in there.
Right. And it's probably important to keep in mind that there will be no the answer.
Right.
Like one answer that is adequate to explain everything. It's tempting to go there because it's uncomfortable to think that we don't know everything.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if there's a commonality among the harsher skeptics, I would say that there's not only cynicism, but there's an inability to comfortably live with ambiguity and with not knowing. And so they want to collapse things prematurely into this is the answer to something. And just you don't need to read a lot of history to realize that that's probably not the way to go. We go with the best model that we have at the moment, but you leave open a lot of room because that model is going to change. All you need to look is at textbooks in virtually any area of academia, and they change regularly because the world keeps changing. Our knowledge keeps changing.
And if you commit too early to any one model and you just, like you said, stuff changes and all you're doing is pushing the model, you're not learning, you're not growing, you're plateauing. That's anti-science. That's anti-everything.
Well, unfortunately, it also is the norm within the academic world. You get promotions, you get tenure in academia by coming up with something new and original, and then you fight like mad to make sure that it is recognized as being a major contribution that will give you your promotions and your tenure. But if somebody comes along after you've created your career on certain ideas and says, you know what, that really wasn't all that comprehensive, or worse, that was wrong, you've made the dominoes fall backwards all the way to the beginning. You're not going to lose tenure, but you lose your status.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the reasons why the academic world is so slow in changing, even to empirical facts, is because there's a lot of careers at stake. They don't want things to be the way that they apparently are. So that's where a lot of the resistance comes from.
Well, I guess we surround ourselves with so much culture that we forget that in many ways, I tend to think that we're transcendent creatures, but we're also these monkey territorial animals. And we've just kind of shifted our territorial violence or territorialism generally into these kind of intellectual domains. So we still sort of have that animal instinct that we haven't transcended. And it's normal in one sense, but it's also totally counterproductive to evolution in certain cases, depending on the context and what have you. Because we live in sort of critical times that need a reorientation of thinking. And so this kind of slow moving inertia is hard to, I guess, deal with. I just want it to change now,
yeah.
You know.
Can we change fast enough? That's the question. Now, we may be forced to change fast enough. When Manhattan is flooded with 10 feet of water because of global warming, you know, then people may be forced to do something new.
Yeah.
But the warming trend, just to use one example, is happening slow enough that I don't know if we're going to be able to change fast enough.
Well, on that sunny note, Dr. Reading, why don't we start wrapping up here, and maybe you can let us know a bit about maybe new projects you're working on or stuff you're doing at IONS or elsewhere and what we should be on the lookout for.
Well, for somebody who wants to get immersed into all this stuff for a while, the IONS biennial conference will happen in July of this year, 2015, outside of Chicago. If you go to the IONS website, ions.org, it's featured on the front page about where and when and all the rest of it. I don't know how many. I've given up trying to count, but I probably do between 20 and 50 interviews and talks a year. Many of them get posted on my website, usually after the fact, though, so I don't always keep up with where I'm going to be. Except, so the only one I know I'm going to be talking at is the IONS conference, which happens every 2 years. And this time for, I think, the first time in a very long time in the Midwest and near Chicago.
Okay, Dean, so thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com.
Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.